Blog Talk Radio.
It is Movie Geeks United. Hey out there, everybody. We got a great show for you tonight from the new film Repo, The Genetic Opera. I know there are tons of fans out there listening and in the chat room. We have a horror legend, Mr. Bill Moseley, one of our great actors. And we're also going to welcome to the show a great horror film composer from the new film Splinter, composer Ilya Smirnov. And speaking of composing, we'll be discussing several new soundtrack score releases from this month and playing you some tracks from those CDs as well. It's Movie Geeks United, and here we go. Thanks for joining us tonight, everybody. It's a great show tonight. Thanks for being patient. We had a little problems the first 10 minutes here, but we're up and running. Jerry, are you with me?
I am with you, and it wouldn't be a Wednesday night, I guess, without a technical clusterfuck. So,
yeah, you can't trust a Wednesday evening without problems. I mean, I just wouldn't know what to do.
I know. It's the norm.
It's the new norm. And Norm MacDonald does have a new show, and that's what it's called, The New Norm. Welcome, everybody. This is a great conversation. We had a conversation earlier today with Bill Moseley. He spent 35 minutes with us, and what a great guy. Very friendly and engaging, and obviously talented. I want to thank a couple of people. First of all, we got the notice 24 hours ago, that we had an opportunity to speak to Bill tonight on tonight's show. And so first of all, I'd like to thank Judy Fox, who made that possible. She has been a real friend to the show, and she represents some class act people, and she's a class act herself and just a joy to work with. Also, the Repo fans out there that helped to spread the word, particularly Chris B., we thank you so much, and thank you all for joining us tonight in the chat room.
These are like the most loyal fans I've seen in a long time. They're incredible.
Yeah, that's just it. And then we talked somewhat about that with Mr. Moseley, too. So without further ado...
Let's do it. Let's go. Let's play it.
Here's our conversation with Bill Moseley. I started off the conversation asking him when horror movies first came into his life, when he started to be a fan.
Yeah, I was a horror fan really ever since I can remember. I think my first horror movie was in the 50s. It was my grandmother took me to see Steve McQueen in The Blob.
Wow.
And when it actually was in the theater, so that really dates me. But I think that might have been 56, 57, 58, something like that. I was just a little sprout, and really scared the crap out of me.
Yeah.
For some reason, I still remember lying in the guest bedroom in my grandmother's apartment in New York City, and insisting that the door stay open with the light on in the hall, and remembering that actually ended up being a problem because the light reflected off the mirror over the dresser at the foot of my bed, and that was scary. I mean, everything, I was just in total fear mode.
Yeah. So they were always influential to you. When did the idea of becoming an actor really take shape for you?
I was always an actor. My parents I grew up in a town called Barrington, Illinois, and my parents, Spence and Gigi, were both actors. They acted in something called the Barrington Play Reading Group, and basically a bunch of parents would get together. I think they did it once a month, and somebody's house was designated as the play reading group house, and this group of people would put on plays. They would read the plays. They would hold the scripts in their hands, but the host would definitely decorate a set, and people would come over, have dinner, watch the play. You know, it was fun for everybody. And
yeah.
I was often drafted for the kids' parts. So I was in one play called Sunrise at Campobello. I played one of the sons of FDR. And I was in a play called Lottery. And I was, I guess, my greatest hit, and I actually won like a little Oscar for it, was in the play A Thousand Clowns. I played Nick.
Wow.
I think Leo Schoenhofen played Chuckles the Chipmunk, and so I was warped early on. And then whenever I was able to, I would sneak in down the hall from my bedroom to the library where the old black and white TV was, and I would sneak past my parents' bedroom and go watch midnight horror films like The Beginning of the End with Giant Grasshoppers and Creature from the Black Lagoon, Creature from Blood Beach. You know, all of those things. It Came from Outer Space and scary movies. And I just really had a thrill for them.
You know what strikes me most about you as an actor is you're such a chameleon. I mean, there are people that play a certain actors that play a certain persona, and they're great in everything they do. And you're great and so different in everything you do. And I'm wondering if the actors that influenced you were of that same ilk?
You know, not necessarily. I mean, I love John Wayne and Clint Eastwood, and they're pretty much John Wayne and Clint Eastwood in their movies.
Yeah.
So I don't mind that. I think a good, strong personality is just fun to watch. I think those are more like the movie stars. For me, what I learned was in order to really give a good performance, you really have to get out of the way. You have to get your ego out of it. What I learned to do was to just trust the script, even if it wasn't very good. Not so much trust the script, but the story, and read the script a bunch of times until it becomes real for you. I think actors really are about selling reality, and what I try to do is just get out of the way and just let the character come through. By doing that, what you end up doing is getting away from you know, considerations like what's the better side of my face to shoot and all that kind of crap that, you know, are those actors' concerns that really end up just kind of getting in the way of really having fun and being that character.
So I just
like to get out of the way. I mean, that's the fun for me. It's not about, hey, there's Bill up on the screen doing a character. That, you know, I think it's much higher praise if someone says, what happened to Bill? There's that character. You know, that's what I really go for.
Sure. And when you in that process, what is your relationship with the director? What is the ideal relationship with the director? Do you enjoy active conversation, or do you just want them to kind of let you play and steer you from there?
You know, I always defer to the director. I think that's just the way it goes. It's like a sailor defers to the skipper and on a ship. And that's really the way I'm built. My favorite relationship is a director who knows what he wants, what he or she wants, who aren't tyrants, but more collaborators. You know, my first big job was on Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 with Toby Hooper, and Toby just loved what I was doing with Chop Top. He just loved Chop Top, and I remember a day when I was actually beating LG's brains in the radio station. I was smashing his head with a claw hammer. And we had done maybe 12 takes of that. It was about 110 degrees inside the little set. It was indoors. It was hot outside, hotter inside, under the lights, sticky blood spraying, Tom Savini kneeling off sets, pumping blood out of poor LG's head. And I was whacking away with this rubber claw hammer. And we did about 12 takes of this. And this is when I was going, you know, going down now, and if I had a hammer, and I was just, you know, coming up with all these different things to say as I was whacking poor LG. And finally, we were about to do, we'd done 12 takes, and we were about to do, and Toby says, hey, that's great. Okay, now let's just do one more. And I remember looking up at Toby and saying, you know, shit, man, am I doing something wrong? And he looked at me and he said, hell no, Bill, I'm just having fun watching.
Yeah.
Now, that to me was so exciting to hear, because that is a guy who, you know, I respect. I just think he's one of the greatest directors, certainly in my genre ever. And for him just to be almost like a kid, just excited just to see me whacking away on poor LG, I mean, it was so much fun.
Well, that's the kind of support you want.
I love it because it is a collaborative process. Acting has to be a collaborative process, and you have to collaborate with a director. A director can certainly have a vision. A director can know what's right and what's wrong, but it's the actor, really, that goes in there and really is slopping around with the reality. And sometimes things just aren't working as written or as conceived. And it's the actors who know, because we're the rubber meeting the road. And so sometimes, you know, you get inspired in the moment and you say to the director, hey, you know, I'd love to say this or try this or whatever. And, you know, it's always great to have a director who encourages that, but also who can be very gentle but firm in telling you that doesn't work for me.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what I like. I like collaborative guys who realize that this is a collaborative effort. I'm not trying to, you know, get anybody's director title or take anybody's salary. It just makes it more fun and better for me to work with somebody. That's why I love certainly Rob Zombie. I love working with Tom Savini, Toby. You know, there's a bunch of directors who I guess aren't threatened. You know, some of them are. Some are that kind of my way or the highway type.
Mm-hmm.
I can work with them too, but it ends up not being as much fun.
Yeah. Well, they hire you to bring your game, to bring your best game to the to the film. So that would be the ideal relationship, I think. Let me ask
Absolutely.
You a quick question about TCM2, and then we'll get right to Repo. You mentioned The Blob as being the first movie that really terrified you as a young child, and the original Texas Chainsaw was that film for me. I have yet to find a more terrifying experience in the movies. But TCM2 was a different animal from the original, and intentionally so. And I'm wondering, as the years have passed, have you witnessed kind of a different appreciation of that film now than when it first came out?
It definitely seems to have legs, and that I'm very grateful about. It's funny because the original Chainsaw freaked me out too. Not in the same way as The Blob. The Blob was just the first horror movie I'd ever seen when I was, you know, six or seven years old. I saw the original Chainsaw, in 75 in the combat zone of Boston, Massachusetts, and, you know, on an afternoon double bill with Enter the Dragon. And I just thought, oh, my God. And I had already graduated from college. I ran a horror film series at college called Things That Go Bump in the Night. You know, I was something of a self-styled horror expert. I saw that on a marquee, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I just thought, oh, what crap is this? And I went in with that kind of an attitude, like a sense of superiority, like, come on, what are they foisting on the American public? And it was on the tail end of that double bill, so I'd already, you know, I'd never seen a Bruce Lee movie before. And so that was kind of fun. It kind of loosened up the Sunday afternoon audience. We were all like, come on, bring it on. And as soon as Chainsaw started playing, just, you know, that opening weird creaky violin music or scratchy sound effects and, you know, there was snapshots of a dissolving corpse. There was a hush that fell over the theater. We all knew something was different and terribly wrong. And that movie never let me go. I mean, I was trying like hell to see the zipper in the costume, something fakey, a microphone cord, just anything to, you know, to say, to pull me out of that reality, and nothing ever did, and it just freaked me out. So that total terror was really why I ended up in Chainsaw 2.
Yeah, it's a brilliant movie, and it's not in the Museum of Modern Art for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, come on.
My plan was to see it. It affected me so adversely that my plan was to see it a bunch of times until it finally became commonplace, and
yeah.
So that I could say, okay, here comes the the jump focus on that red generator, and here is there's that cutaway to the daddy long legs in the abandoned house, and instead each time I watched it, it seemed to just pound that wedge deeper into my skull.
Yeah.
And finally, the only way that I was able to exorcise that really negative impact of the original Chainsaw was ultimately to join the family,
mm-hmm.
you know, which I did by making a short film called The Texas Chainsaw Manicure,
right?
Which
right.
Was a five-minute spoof set in a beauty parlor in Staten Island, which a friend of mine who worked in Hollywood at the time actually walked into Toby. And Toby saw it, and I did a cameo as the hitchhiker at the end of it. And Toby saw it, and from a 20-second appearance in the Texas Chainsaw Manicure, he hired me as Chop Top.
Mm. Yeah,
and so ultimately, you know, I mean, that's how I overcame my fear, was I joined the family instead of ran from them.
And what a great performance you give in that movie. And I know it has to be probably the most oft-quoted movie from your fans. They probably always approach you and quote that movie more than any other, I would think.
They love Chainsaw. Chainsaw had a lot of quotable lines in it, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But I got to say that I owe 99% of that performance to Ed Neal, the original hitchhiker. I just thought his performance as the hitchhiker in the original Chainsaw was really, really blew my mind. I think that was one of the strongest elements of what really freaked me out about the original, was just
yeah.
how strange and loopy Ed Neal was. And really, so I, you know, Chop Top was Chop Top, but there's so much of Ed Neal in that, just, you know, inspiration-wise.
Yeah, it's just great. Let's talk about Repo. This is a movie that, I mean, I haven't experienced this level of fandom for a film in a long, long time. This is a very special, outside-of-the-box kind of project, and we spoke to Darren about it for a length last week.
Yeah,
and
I know.
He was wonderful.
He is Repo.
You know, but the one question that we didn't ask of Darren, and it seems so odd, is about the plot of the film. So could you give us a sense, for those that don't necessarily know out there in our listening audience, what the film is about and the character that you portray in the film?
Well, the Repo is set, I think, in 2052. It might be off a year or two, but it's set in the not-too-distant future. It is it's certainly a dystopia, which I looked up and found out it's a utopia gone terribly wrong. And in it, there has been an epidemic of organ failure, probably brought on by the environment, bad food, who knows what. A company has emerged with all these millions of deaths from organ failure. A company called GeneCo has emerged, which actually sells organs to people, and it really has saved hundreds of thousands of lives. And what it does is it provides organs if you need a heart, lungs, spine, all kinds of different organs and body parts to people with on liberal credit terms. So if you need that heart, man, you can get one for with a down payment of maybe $100 and $50 a month or something. And which will keep you alive. The only problem is if you don't make your payments, Congress has authorized GeneCo to send out operatives called the Repo Men, and it is their legal right to repossess what is GeneCo's, and even if it costs the life of the person that it's repossessed from. So if you owe on your heart, and you ain't making your payments, you can expect a visit from the repo man who will remove that heart and take it back to the company and leave your dead body lying on the street. So that is basically the background of Repo. The plot is really revolves, there are kind of two strains. One is one plot is it's really the story between a father and a daughter. The father is played by Anthony Stewart Head of Buffy fame. And he is, by day, a mild-mannered doctor, but by night...
he's a repo man.
And he has a daughter, Shiloh, played by Alexa Vega from Spy Kids. She's a 17-year-old who is sickly, and but at the same time, and she's kind of kept almost under house arrest by her father. And it's all about her coming of age and wanting to get out and see things and a father's love and a father's kind of smothering protectiveness. The other side of the coin is the head of Repo is Rati Largo, played amazingly by Paul Sorvino. And Paul Sorvino, with his operatic baritone pipes, sings, is an amazing singer. So, of course, this opera is right up his alley. And he is the father of three ne'er-do-well kids, played by me and played by Ogre of Skinny Puppy. And our sister is played by Paris Hilton. And the three of us, Rati has pretty much given up on us, and yet he is coughing a little bit, so we're starting to think who's going to succeed him. So that is the other plot, is us struggling with each other, trying to figure out who will be the next head of GeneCo.
What a cast. I mean, what a great eclectic cast in this film.
Oh, it's amazing.
And it's a music, it's an opera. I mean, it's aptly titled The Genetic Opera.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that dynamic, because I would think a lot of your performance you're giving in that recording studio months before you actually shoot. What kind of a different dynamic is that? What does that do to your performance when you're in front of the camera?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. At first, I had never done anything like that, so I did not have... first of all, you have to trust the director a lot more than you would in a non-pre-recorded movie, because, of course, the director is saying, at this point in the story, here's what you're feeling, this is what's happened, and he has to give you that information, which you then have to translate into a vocal performance, which then, when you actually get on the soundstage months later, you are basically stuck with whatever you've done in the recording. So you really have to, you have to trust the director that he knows what the right emotional temperature of any given scene is, and sing it, and then hope that when it's time to actually play it, the emotion and the vocals matches the emotion in the scene. That actually worked out great, as it turned out. So we all trusted Darren and the co-creators, Terrence Zadunich and Darren Smith, and they knew this story and this play inside out. So they really were very accurate with their descriptions of the different scenes and the different temperatures of the scenes. So that was great. I didn't really know, so I recorded it, and that was a fun experience. But then getting to the set, seeing the sets, the costumes, the makeup, having to do not only the singing but also the choreography, and then somehow trying to play, again, the emotional truth of the scene, it seemed like a lot the first couple of days on the set. I just, it seemed like it might be a problem because I just wasn't used to singing, dancing, lip syncing, and still trying to find moments in the actual scene. But you know what? It was so much fun. Darren Bousman was so clear about what he wanted and what he needed from each of the actors in each of the scenes that it ended up, once I kind of got the new language, it ended up being easy and a lot of fun.
Yeah. And when you wear makeup and different costumes and disguises and things in your films, I'm sure it has an effect on you, and it kind of builds the character, gives him a different stance or a different feel. When you're singing a part, does it animate you in a different way? Does it free you in some sense as an actor?
Absolutely. It definitely pumps you up. I mean, you are filled with air, and so it does end up making you bigger. You know, I just found that I was squaring my shoulders more. I wasn't, you know, my posture was always pretty good just because I had to keep my lungs filled with air.
Right.
What I would do,
right,
too, and what we were all encouraged to do, was to actually sing along with the tracks so that not only does it look like, you know, not only does the lip sync work, but also the diaphragm has to go up and down, or else you really look like a dope.
Yeah.
So just the, again, the dynamic of singing every line. Again, I found out that a musical is songs connected by dialogue, and an opera is everything is sung. So because there was singing the whole time, also because there were meters, you know, you had to keep with the rhythm. If it was 3-4, 2-4, whatever it is, 7-8, I don't even know what those meters are, but, you know, you had to keep up. So that was another thing that just kind of forced a certain extra animation on all of us.
Yeah, I bet. Let me get to some of these fan questions, and then I'll let you off the hook. You've been great with us with your time, and thank you so much for the time you've given us.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
Let me see here. Tamsin the Twisted and Zola both want to know, would you consider attending a fan-sponsored convention?
Sure. Absolutely.
There you go.
I guess that's a yes or no question, right?
I think that's all you got.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. I mean, I go. There are lots of horror conventions throughout the U.S. and actually abroad as well. And I try to hit maybe 8 or 9 conventions a year. It's great. You know, it's a way to meet the fans, let them kind of see who their heroes are, kick our tires. Sometimes that's a good thing. Sometimes not so good. You know, because not everybody is not all the actors are fan friendly. But I really enjoy it a lot. So I just like to go out there and take pictures with the fans, meet them, greet them. You know,
it is all about that, isn't it? Because I find that horror fans are very special and loyal and very excitable breed. I mean, they're a great family, aren't they?
You know, they really are. They're some of the smartest people I've met consistently in terms of groups. You know, and a lot of times they'll come in inky and pierced and wearing black T-shirts and you know, looking for all the world like they would be kind of scary people to meet. And I find that they're really just incredibly loyal, friendly, smart, sensitive. I love the horror fans.
Yeah.
And the good news is I am a horror fan, so, you know, it's just fun for me also to go to conventions. It's kind of like instead of looking around the room and seeing a bunch of dentists at a dentist convention, when you're at a horror convention, you look across the hall and there's, you know, Doug Bradley, there's Pinhead, there's Gunnar Hansen, Leatherface, there's Kane Hodder, you know, squeezing somebody's neck, and, you know, Sid Haig is one of my best friends on the circuit, and
yeah,
you just look around, you see these people, and you just go, man, I'm in heaven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great family to
horror
be part of,
heaven.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wolfchild wants to know your least favorite part of acting.
Well, let's see. You know, I guess it's a good thing that there's nothing that really jumps out.
Yeah.
You know, I don't mind sitting in the makeup chair. I guess, you know, that first day is scary. I guess maybe the scary part is, you know, being afraid that you're not going to remember your lines. But then again, you know, there have been so many times when I haven't remembered my lines and they've done a second take. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, they don't take you out and shoot you if you forget a line or if you drop a line.
Right.
So that isn't it. I don't really have, there isn't really a downside. I guess if the check doesn't clear.
that would be it, yeah.
That would suck.
I'll ask two more for you. Nicole V.
I will give you one downside. The downside is working with people who don't love the genre. You know, there are a lot of times when the horror genre is considered easy because, you know, all you need is a couple of rubber monsters and naked chicks. And, you know, there are a lot of people that have a very cynical attitude about the genre. They figure, oh, the fans will eat it up. The kids will love it. Who cares if it looks stupid? And those are the people I don't like working with, to tell you the truth. I've worked
yeah.
with some of them, and that's no fun. Because then, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it's not dignified. I think if you work with people who love the genre, like Rob Zombie, Toby Hooper, Darren Bousman, Tom Savini, George Romero, Sam Raimi I've worked with, guys that really not only they respect the genre as well as love it,
mm-hmm.
then it just makes my work, because I love and respect the genre, it just makes my work a lot more fun. And if you get somebody that's just going, the kids will eat it up, you know, it really just sucks.
Yeah, and we spoke about this with Darren last week, and I've made an observation that performance in horror films, I think those performances are so underrated, because just by their nature, they have to be played at such a feverish pitch, and I would think it would be just an incredibly draining process and take a lot of energy to make those kinds of moments work in a horror film. And I don't think horror film performers get enough credit for the great work that they do. Let me see here. Let me ask you one more. Find a good one here. Okay. A Blind Helix wants to know, if you could make use of one of Jinko's services, is there any part of yourself that you'd like to replace?
Well, replace or augment? You know, I'm coming up on a birthday, too. Actually, November 11th is my birthday. You know, and I'm getting a little long in the tooth here, but I would say that actually I'm okay. I'm feeling okay with myself. You know, I got enough hair, and you know, my limbs work. You know, like everything works. I don't have to take little blue pills for anything, which is good. And
yeah,
still like to hike in the mountains and swim, and you know, just stay active, chase after the pets and the kids. And yeah, I think I'm good.
I just wanted to let you know that we have a lot of questions too from women that are very fond of you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to ask any of these questions; they're pretty racy. So, but I just want to let you know that you have a big female fan base out there.
You know, it's so funny because Otis is a favorite of a lot of fans, and
yeah.
It's so funny because when I first did Otis, I really thought Rob wanted a kind of warmed over Chop Top.
Mm-hmm.
And Chop Top, as you recall, was really the center of Chop Top's gravity was really in the shoulders. You know, there's a lot of going on, a lot of hunching shoulders. That's where
right.
the hand and the lighter and the coat hanger, it was all. You know, all of Chop Top happened within about a foot and a half of the head plate. And so it was really all up in the shoulders. And with Otis, I remember Rob kind of gently but firmly walking me away from Chop Top. And at Chop Top at that point, you know, that was my claim to fame. And I really didn't want to let go of Chop Top. Chop Top was kind of like my security blanket, and mm-hmm. for understandably. And Rob gently but firmly walked me to Otis. And Otis, what Rob had in mind was a kind of a sex symbol dude, like a badass, long-haired, I don't know, Manson-like, this charismatic, sexy, badass, crazy guy. And I didn't really even, I had no clue that an Otis lived within me. I really thought of myself as a nerd, and I was much more comfortable as kind of a squinchy chop-top character. And what happened was that as I developed Otis with Rob's help and support, that center of gravity went of chop-tops from the sternum, the shoulders, went right down into the balls. And Otis was much more about kind of a stance with thumbs under the belt and a wide stance like bring it on.
Right.
And I was surprised. I was as surprised to get to Otis. And then, you know, when I got to Otis, Otis was a hell of a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It was so funny because it was kind of the same surprise when Rob turned to me Super Bowl Sunday of 2004 and said, you know, we're doing another one of these. We're going to do a sequel to House of a Thousand Corpses. And in this one, I think Otis should have a beard. And I remember thinking, what? Otis should have a beard. And he said, so you should start growing a beard. And I said, man, I've never grown a beard. I don't think I got a beard in me.
Right.
And 4 months later, when I hit the set to start Devil's Rejects, I had this butt-kicking beard. I mean, I didn't even know it was in there. It had been hiding in my jaw for many, many years. And again, with Rob's encouragement, although it was my follicles, out came this pretty amazing beard. And, you know, between my beard and their hair and, you know, Wayne Toth's blood and, you know, everything else and, you know, and Gold's Gym, you know, Otis was born and, you know, has really excited a lot of women, and it's very cool. It's a little frustrating because I've, you know, I've been with the same woman for 15 years.
Why could this have happened before I got married?
No,
yeah, exactly.
Man. Where was Otis when I was, you know, in my 20s in New York City?
And we got people like Poland, the screen name Poland 626. He even talks about Otis, or it's probably she. I'm not sure, but
hey, either way,
and how
know,
much
everybody,
yeah,
loves
how
Otis.
Much they love that film. Yeah, are you working with Rob Zombie again in the future? I know he's working on something called Tyrannosaurus Rex, I believe.
You know, we've talked a little bit about it. I actually was the first trick or treater. I took my 10-year-old and girlfriend over to trick or treat Rob and Sherry a couple nights ago.
Oh,
so I've seen him recently. You know, we haven't talked much about Tyrannosaurus Rex. I don't really know much about it other than what I've seen on the MySpace page, a couple of weird painted posters. I know that Rob just locked, I think he just locked El Super Bisto, the haunted world of El Super Bisto, which is feature-length animated movie.
Yeah.
And I come back and do a cameo as Otis, actually, in that.
Oh, wow. Great.
Yeah, and that's, I don't know when that's coming out, or I think the Weinstein Company, the same company that put out Halloween, is putting out The Haunted World of El Super Bisto. I don't know what the distribution of that is. But, yeah, I mean, I stay friends with Rob and, you know, love working with him. So I would imagine there's you know, a lot more work in the future.
Well, that's a great collaboration there. That's a great pairing, the two of you, definitely. I want to let you know that Jake Reardon and Chris B are both crazy about you, and they got the word out about you being on the show tonight, and I want to thank them very much. Will you be traveling with Repo? I know that people are working very hard in different regions to get sold-out shows, for instance, in Orlando here at the Enzian. That's already been a sold-out show there. Do you plan on traveling at all with it?
I don't. I'm flying tomorrow to Las Vegas. I know that Repo, the U.S. premier red carpet showing of Repo, is tomorrow night. I think it's at Planet Hollywood in Las Vegas, and so I am flying out for that. Beyond that, then Friday night, I have the opening of another movie I'm in, actually, that's opening this week called House. It's based on a Ted Decker novel of the same title, and stars Michael Madsen, Leslie Easterbrook, Lou Temple, You know, you'll know them from The Devil's Rejects, and it's kind of a haunted house movie, and that's actually opening in a lot more theaters than Repo, actually, and that's opening this Friday as well as Repo. What's amazing to me
busy.
Is that Repo is only opening in seven theaters, I think seven or eight theaters in the entire United States, which to me is just plain weird, just because it's such a fabulous movie. It's the kind of movie that, yes, it's coming out on DVD, but it's so big and theatrical that it really needs to be seen on the big screen. And why it's only opening in seven theaters, when a movie like House, which is, you know, certainly cool, a little more traditional, I guess, but it's opening on 341 screens. I just, you know, I just wonder about that, but I guess that's, you know, that's why it's, you know, a labor of love for us repo people. Work hard to, you know, get the word out.
And I think that people are just dying to see something different.
Yeah.
Everything is a carbon copy, cookie cutter imitation of everything else. And this is really an original film. And I think that's what fans are responding to, and that's the movement that they're creating here around Repo. So, Mr. Mosley, I appreciate
you. You know, we've just seen America vote for change, so maybe they can vote for Repo.
Do it in your multiplex, too. Absolutely.
That's right. It's a lot more
fun.
It'll
be a great day for America.
In those long lines to, you know, put the little marker on your ballot, man. You can go, you know, go to your multiplex. You can get some popcorn, a drink, and sit down in a comfortable seat and look up and get your mind blown for an hour and a half.
Exactly. I'd vote for that. Absolutely. Yeah. Mr. Mosley, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
It's been great. We're crazy about you. Come back anytime you'd like.
I'd love to, and thank you so much, and thanks for your support. And I want to thank all the fans, because I ain't done yet.
Thank you so much, Mr. Mosley.
All right.
All right. Bye-bye now.
Okay. Bye.
All right. There's our conversation with Bill Mosley. Jerry,
that
you're back
incredible.
On.
That was great. You know, just trying to follow that in the chat, you know. The chat's just going by rapid fire, you know. I mean, as
Crazy.
Mr. Brian pointed out last week, I've never seen the chat room move so fast.
Yeah, you guys are a bunch of crazy people. We love you. But...
We love you. I've never seen anything in the last three shows, because we had a lot on the other night, too. It's just been, you guys are great. We love you.
Yeah.
We love having you on.
And Bill Mosley was just fantastic. You can tell he's a genuine article. He's no airs about him. He loves what he does. He's
pretension whatsoever.
Yeah, he's in touch with the fans.
Yeah.
And that's important, because especially working in this genre, well, it's true across the board, but the fans are the bread and butter. You know?
I think the fans, and I think that's going to become, as we move on, I think with a lot of the different genres, I hope that other filmmakers and actors and I think in horror, they realize the fans are the lifeblood. They're on the festival circuit, the convention circuit. They're the people that, you know, they're the ones, you know, let's put it like this. The fans are the ones that make your paycheck possible. And I know a lot of people don't believe that, but it's the truth. That's the way it works.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Speaking of the fans that make the paycheck possible, a couple of people on the line here. And I think this is Chris B. Chris B, is this you?
Yeah.
Hey.
Hey, hello? Chris.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm good. You guys made me blush so hard.
Because I mentioned your screen name, name there. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I wasn't expecting that.
That's my job, to make you blush. So
yeah,
I feel I've
done my
duty.
I'm easy, so yeah.
Well, that's encouraging.
Okay, I didn't mean it that way.
So tell us again, you're handling the Orlando market.
Yes.
And that screening is November 16th, and you guys are trying to get an additional screening up and running too, right?
Yes, we are begging for one. We've got hate mail on our MySpace.
Wait, what do you mean hate mail? What do you mean?
People are contacting our MySpace Army profile, like, angry at us because there's no more tickets, and they're, like, trying to get tickets from us, and we tell them we don't have any. We're not like holding them back for special people.
Right, right.
Know?
Okay. I see what you mean. Okay.
What they should do, I don't know how they're formatted, the NZN. It's been, are they two screens?
I'm not sure. People from who are actually living in Orlando would probably know that answer better than me.
I went there once, but that was like, I saw Affliction there like 12 years ago, so it's been a while. I don't know if there was a single movie house.
Man, that was a while ago.
Yeah, I don't know if they're a single movie house or they have two screens. If they have two screens, they could probably sync up the projectors and open it on two theaters instead of one. I mean, that's an idea too. But
whatever way they want to do it, I don't care. If they were able to do it two at the same time, that would save me a lot of trouble because I have to plan the after party too.
Okay. Well, that's the important stuff. What's going on with the after party?
We are looking into venues right now because I only found out about my responsibilities in that on Sunday. But as soon as I know anything, it'll be posted up on the MySpace.
Okay.
So this is like wherever it's playing. Are they trying to do the same thing with a? Obviously, they're trying to get sold out screenings. But are they planning after parties? Is this a movement that's beyond Orlando?
Yes. Everybody who is an area leader, who has their own little armies, is planning after parties for Darren and Tarrant. And I'm actually, that's why whenever I originally called in, I asked him about how he's going to be able to handle the road tour because I don't know how he's going to get any sleep. I really don't.
Yeah. This is really indicative, too, of the power of the internet because I'm sure you guys, without the internet, it would be so hard to rally this enthusiasm and rally the troops, so to speak, to make this kind of stuff happen. I mean, the internet really has changed the way movies are marketed, and this is just another example of that.
Yeah, we've had so much fun. It's really been a journey. I got into Repo in March, and then I started paying more and more attention until it got to the point where I had to be on the boards every day to see what was happening, and then all of a sudden it exploded. You know, Darren started hosting chats with celebs, so I've gotten a chance to talk with Alexa Vega. I got to chat with Bill Moseley, and oh my God, Anthony Stewart had I about died. I just talked to him today, actually. He's my favorite. So,
Anthony Head, is that what you said?
Yes, Anthony Head is my favorite.
Okay, we'll try to get him too.
Oh my God, if you do, I would die. Can I call in, please?
Do I have a choice? No, I'm kidding.
Not really, because I hoard for you. You have to answer the phone.
I know you do, and I really, really appreciate it. And I appreciate all the listeners that you've brought in, and I hope you guys stick with us, and we'll do what we can to make you guys happy.
I plan to stay. I don't know how much I can talk the rest of the people into, but I have a lot of good friends here, and I think they're all really starting to like your guys' show, too, so I'm sure you'll see us more often.
Thank you. We're about to play some really awful James Bond themes, so hopefully we can keep hold of their support.
Okay, I need to say one thing for Little Glass Vial, because I promised.
Mm-hmm.
Boob.
That's great. Could you say
that
slower?
That's it. Boob.
Oh, yes. Well, that's all we need. The show's done, Jerry. That's all we need.
The show's
done. Oh, okay.
Boob,
all right, there you go.
Brought on air.
At least I'm done. I don't know about you.
Okay, guys, I'll talk to you later.
Thank you, Chris.
All right,
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm, no problem. Bye.
Okay. Thanks for calling in. Okay, Repo, you heard it, and we'll try to get some additional talents from that because it's going to be obviously with 7 release dates, it's going to be a platform release 1 week after another throughout the month of November and I'm sure into subsequent months. So. Let's build this movement. I'm always encouraged to see people enthusiastic about movies, whatever movie it is.
Right.
You know, that's what we're all about. So let's get to our next segment, which is about soundtracks. And at the bottom of the hour here at 11:30 Eastern, 8:30 Pacific, a great composer by the name of Elias Smirow is going to join us to talk about some great mini scores that he's done, including Frankenheimer's Ronin, and the new film Splinter.
Right.
And also talk about electronic music. I'm very interested in that because he uses a lot of those devices for his compositions. But we've got a couple of soundtracks that have come in. I got a soundtrack today called Flash of Genius for that film that came in just today.
Right.
We're gonna play
that movie.
Yeah, I was shocked. It seemed like the perfect movie at this time, you know. But I'm going to, first of all, we're going to discuss a little James Bond. The Quantum of Solace is coming up. I think that's the 107th James Bond film. it's coming out next Friday, and in commemoration of that, they're releasing a CD here, The Best of Bond, James Bond, and includes all the themes from the films, or at least the large majority of the themes. I thought it'd be fun to play a little collection of these themes. I edited together a little something. This is a lot of fun, and maybe it'll take you guys back. Here's some music from Bond, James Bond.
Goldfinger, he's the man with a Midas touch, a spider's touch.
He knows the meaning of success. His need.
reflection on the water, more than darkness in the depths. See him surface and never a shadow. On the wind, I feel his breath. Golden eye, I found his weakness. Golden eye, you do what I please. Golden eye.
Let me just name a couple of tracks I didn't play mercifully, according to some people in the chat room. The Living Daylights, Aha, that's a classic.
But it's a great John Barry score, though, regardless of what I think that was.
Oh, the score
really
is always the score
is good.
Yeah.
No, I think when you get in the Pierce Brosnan era, I don't think there's a song I like. I mean, the Madonna one, I'm listening to that. My God, I forgot how bad that was. I like Madonna's music, but that just. God, that was awful.
What about the Tina Turner, the Golden Eye?
I didn't like any of the Brosnan title, and I wanted to like the one by Garbage, especially because The World Is Not Enough is like the Bond family crap.
What about the Sheryl Crow, The Tomorrow Never Dies? See, I think the Katie Lang was part of the same movie, the movie score. I think the Katie Lang worked better as a main theme.
I agree with you 100%.
And who would have thought that Katie Lang would work for James Bond?
I know, the irony.
Yeah. But there's also, let's see, Gladys Knight, License to Kill, Chris Cornell, You Know My Name.
That grows on me, the Chris Cornell, actually, because I got the album that's on, actually, and that's probably the best song on the CD. I have to say something. I still like Chris Cornell a lot. I've gone to see him in concert a lot, solo and with Soundgarden, and... The Bond song is actually the first good Bond song, I would have to say, since, oh, God, the Sheena Easton one for Your Eyes Only, maybe.
Right.
Yeah.
What else do we got? You Only Live Twice, Nancy Sinatra. You know what really strikes me?
Shirley Bassey was the one for me.
Yeah. What really is funny to me, how Tom Jones managed to incorporate the title Thunderball in a song.
I always get a kick out of that whenever I hear it.
That's classic.
Yeah.
That's a thing of beauty. And the thing about the Bond songs are, even if they're bad songs, which...
They're catchy.
frequently they are. They're good in a kind of, like I told you earlier tonight, a kitschy kind of way, like really in a cheesy way.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the tradition, even if I don't like the Bond song. I like the tradition of the Bond movies.
Right. Oh,
the
yeah.
Over-the-top opening action sequence, the weird computer graphic title sequence they do with
yeah.
a new song each movie. I'm a sucker for that.
Oh, yeah. You know, someone I worked with a long time ago, another job, thought the Bond movies dated themselves, and they do. Some of them, I think the Roger Moore ones more so now than the Sean Connery ones, but they do date themselves, but they're so much fun to watch that you, when they come on, unless it's on Turner, the TBS, where they're on for like 5 or 6 hours with all the commercials, I always get sucked into them. Always.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And obviously it's a legacy of music and a lot of artists that took part.
Do
so that's
you have
all
a favorite score, though?
No, I don't have a favorite score. I have a favorite recent Bond movie, though, and it's nobody else's favorite. And that's Tomorrow Never Dies.
That was kind of ahead of its time with the media, like the Ted Turner-like villain, Rupert Murdoch kind of villain.
I think that. But mostly, for Bond, it's always a jaw-dropping action sequence. And the more jaw-dropping, the better for me. I want to see crap that would never occur in real life. That's why I go to action movies. I don't need realism. And that opening scene of Goldeneye, like when he jumps off the cliff on the motorcycle and catches up to the plane.
Oh,
that's about to crash.
Goldeneye has, I think, some of the best of the Brosnan. I think it's the best of the Brosnan. But that, the tank chase in St. Petersburg.
Yeah.
there's a whole bunch of. I love the in the base at the end. Like there's a lot of great action stunts and everything in that. I still think that was the best that they gave Pierce.
Well, I like Tomorrow Never Dies because it doesn't suffer from the thing that most Bond movies suffer for me. They don't have that really slow middle up until you get to the outrageous closing action sequence. I mean, Tomorrow Never Dies, I felt really action.
It also has Michelle Yeoh.
That's a great addition too.
Yeah.
By all accounts, Quantum of Solace is a lot like that. It's nonstop action.
It seems that it's going to be, as someone said, now. One review, I guess it was the first review, the BBC review, said that it plays like a very dark, violent second act. So,
mm-hmm.
And now there's no word on the third film, but I'm assuming there's still some loose ends at the end of this one. So, but they just say it's like Bourne, basically. It's like the Bourne ultimatum, essentially, with James Bond.
Yeah, yeah. Let's play a couple of score tracks here. There's a couple more scores that are available. There's two Middle Eastern kind of themed movies. One, I think, has already went. We played this track weeks ago, but we're going to play it again in contrast to the first one we're playing. The first one we're playing is from Body of Lies, which is the new Leonardo DiCaprio Russell Crowe movie.
That's come and gone already.
Yeah, but the soundtrack just came out.
Oh, okay.
And it has Middle Eastern influences, as the film does. As does the second track we're going to play, which is Traitor.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting how they incorporate these sounds into the scores, and I think it's a really dynamic sound. So we'll play these back-to-back. These are great, great pieces, starting with Body of Lies, followed by Traitor.
Thank you.
Body of Lies, Mark Strettenfield, and here is the main theme for Traitor by Mark Killian, and we spoke with him last month if you're interested in looking up a great composer interview. Body of Lies and Traitor. Those are great scores, actually.
I actually think the Traitor scores is actually much better. I really have to say that. It stays with you. I think the Body of Lies, I mean, it's good, but I think, like, the movie, it's forgetful. I think the Traitor stays with you a lot longer, I think. I think it's a better score. It's a better film, personally. I think, personally, it's a better film. The Body of Lies, it's funny, the soundtrack didn't leave much of an impression on me, but Traitor did.
Yeah, but they're similar.
Oh, they are, because of the theme, so I'm not doubting that. It's just, I think the guy who did Traitor, it's a better score.
Yeah. One more quick score to play for you before we bring on our next guest.
Okay.
Flash of Genius is Aaron Zygmunt. Jerry, did you get to see this movie?
It came and went, dude. The next, you know how sometimes if the movie doesn't do well the first weekend, the next weekend it's either gone or it's down like the one showtime, and it's usually like the earliest showtime you're at work or during it. So yeah, I was surprised it didn't stay long at all.
Flash Genius, composer Aaron Zygmunt. It's available now in stores. Here's a track. Yeah, story of an underdog, a guy that takes on a big corporation, a committed family guy going through a crisis. Those are all the sounds that you hear in that score, apparently, because I didn't catch the movie either. I was excited about it, though.
Yeah, we were both excited about it.
Yeah.
I like Greg Kinnear a lot. He's been on a roll lately. I was really surprised it didn't catch on.
Yeah. You know a movie I like with Greg Kinnear?
Which one?
It's a movie I always enjoy watching. I always get crap for this. Stuck on You.
That was a surprisingly sweet movie.
It really is. It's a really good-hearted movie.
Yeah, I like it. I thought it was very funny. I didn't expect to like it at all. You know, I was like, you know, I thought it'd be really stupid. And, you know, it is an outlandish premise, but it worked, and I just was taking how sweet it was.
And that was really touching.
Yeah.
Towards the end there. And who would have thought that, you know, usually when you use the word touching in reference to a Farrelly Brothers movie, you're talking about something else. But I always liked that one. Okay, we're awaiting the call from our next and our final guest. So while we're doing that, what would you like to discuss tonight, Jerry?
What would I like to discuss? Can we talk about anything we want, or I guess it's not like potluck, I guess, is it?
I tell you what, let's do what I suggested a little bit ago. Let's get some suggestions from the chat room, if we can. This is our version of political talk. Following the monumental night last night. If someone were to make a film on Obama up to this point, who would you cast as the major players here?
Don Cheadle. Someone said Don Cheadle. That's a good choice.
Yes.
I wonder if anyone's going to say Fred Armisen. when Obama said, "Why is it the guy who's playing me not funny?" He did say that.
Okay, look. Yeah. That's a good suggestion, Don Cheadle. I was talking to you. I was thinking, Obama seems to be like the African-American Jimmy Stewart. So isn't Denzel Washington the closest we have to that?
He would be a very good Obama.
Morgan Freeman is too old. Obviously, he's, you know, the voice of God. But
yeah, he's the voice of God. But no, Denzel Washington and Don Cheadle are both very good. Trying to think, who else? I think the man is so charismatic that only he could play him, though. So that's sort of my take on it right now.
Joe Biden,
Alec Baldwin. That was just off the cuff because there's just someone who puts their foot in the mouth so much.
Right. I could see it. He could gray his hair and slick it back and put in some dentures and
Jamie Foxx. Poland mentioned Jamie Foxx.
Jamie Foxx would not make a good Joe Biden. I'm sorry.
No, I wasn't talking about that. because we've watched this unfold for the last 2 years, and a lot of us have watched Biden for such a long time, and Obama for the last 4 years, really, since the 2004 Democratic National Convention. It's so hard to imagine someone playing them in this kind of media culture we have with the 24-hour news and the internets. It's so hard for me to think of anyone playing them, but there will be a day when there will be a movie will probably be made of this, or some sort of media will be made.
It's history.
Yeah.
I mean, it's history-making, so of
course.
Yeah,
it is. What happened yesterday is...
Yeah, and speaking of history-making, this is interesting, how California turned down, what was it? Was it Proposition 8 in California?
Proposition 8, yeah.
That's what it was called in California. Or so they voted to keep marriage defined the way it is, essentially. But what does that do to milk? I'm thinking about milk, and milk is more relevant and in a way sad as it's.
It's more timely than one would think, and some editorials last week from people who can't review it but wrote editorials say they thought it was very sad that why is this, you know, that this is still going on, but as of yesterday. Yes, the film is very important. More so, I think, than they originally intended because of this.
I'll also offer Anthony Mackie as Obama. I think Anthony Mackie.
What about Jeffrey Wright? Do you think Jeffrey Wright?
Sensational actor. I don't think he has the voice, but Anthony Mackie is a sensational
yes,
actor.
Yes, no, you're right. You're right.
That's great. Yeah, Milk is it's bittersweet because we've come so far on one level, making history on one level, but it's not time yet. Apparently,
yeah. I don't understand it. I don't know why people have a problem with that. I really don't.
And you know, so it's interesting. It's interesting how movies reflect that. And when things are that prescient, when a movie is that prescient, will people react to it? Will people go to see it because of that, or will they turn away?
I think Milk has potential because of. The last words of the trailer, you have to give them hope. Because without hope, you have nothing. And I think that's going to ring true to a lot of people this year. I actually think Milk has given the subject matter and the seriousness and the current events, I actually think Milk has a very good chance of not only being a critical hit, but also a box office. I'm not saying like a huge box, but enough that enough people will go see it.
Mm-hmm. How about Whoopi Goldberg as Michelle Obama?
I like Whoopi Goldberg, especially on The View, but I don't see that happening.
Okay, Poland, that is you on the line, Poland. In all sincerity, is that you on the line?
973 is New Jersey.
Okay. Did you want to talk, or were you just calling in so you could hear the show? I know the archive listeners think I'm talking to myself. I'm a schizophrenic. All right. That's going to be interesting. And Milk is one of the films that I'm really looking forward to this season. I think it's one of the big Oscar contenders as well.
I think it's the big Oscar contender.
Up to it, man. These early reviews of it are glowing. The Variety and Hollywood Reporter.
I think it's between Rourke and Penn. I really do believe that right now. It's between Mickey Rourke and Sean Penn.
And Mickey Rourke, what a story that would be.
Talk about a great year all around.
Yeah, that would be exceptional. I believe our guest is on the line now.
Okay.
We're very excited to speak with him. Ilya Smirnov, and I hope I pronounced that name right because you know how terrible I am at that kind of thing.
No better, so don't worry about it.
He is a fantastic composer. He's composed works from John Frankenheimer's Ronin to television series like Nash Bridges. Very versatile. And his new composition is in service of the critically acclaimed new horror film Slither. Have you read the reviews of this? They're very enthusiastic.
The one in the Wall Street Journal is the review that I would recommend everyone go read. I have not read it. Such an enthusiastic review of a horror film in a long time. And it's a great review, and I cannot wait to see this film.
Yeah, and EW was raving about it, said that it was just a good, strong, fun, scary, you know, kind of film and a great experience. So we're very excited to speak with this gentleman tonight, and here he is, Mr. Ilya Smirnov. Mr. Smirnov, are you with us?
I am here. Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's a great pleasure to have you on.
Thank you for having me here.
Now, I pronounced your name correctly.
Absolutely. I was amazed, yes.
great.
You
That's
made
a first.
It. You made
That's
it.
A first. Tell me a little bit about yourself. We're fascinated with composers here. We just admire them so. Tell me when music started to enter your life and when you thought film composition might be for you.
I started very young, about maybe 10, 11, something like that. Playing guitar for girls in the backyard. That was a good start. And then I formed a rock band in high school, playing bass guitar and drums and piano. Taught basically myself all the instruments. And later I went to music conservatory, a little bit more serious studies.
Right. Now, you studied electronic music. Is that part of what you studied?
Yeah, first at conservatory, of course, in Prague, it was a very serious traditional schooling. Later in Sweden and Stockholm, I studied electronic music and music concrete. in electronic studio EMS, which there was terrific 2 years or 1.5 year experience.
Yeah. Tell me about that discipline with electronic music, because it's obviously it's becoming more and more frequent and more popular in certain films. What? How is it a different kind of discipline than the typical composition that we've come to know in the past?
Well, this was completely different than the scenario you have today. I'm talking about 1995, something like this neighborhood, meaning no samplers or very primitive 1.5 second sampling time.
Right.
So all the studies were basically starting from Schoenberg, Berio, Stockhausen, of course, electronic composers, cutting tapes, doing noises on old piano and cymbals and gongs, and then by changing speed, playing backwards, and through harmonizers, through different processing, getting some kind of variety of sound. So basically, a lot of loops running at the same time and on different speed, variable speed as well on tape recorders.
Mm-hmm.
No libraries, no distorted reality libraries
right.
like that we have today. So completely different kind of approach to electronic music, but very interesting. And today, when I using libraries, I kind of think the very similar way. Like here's a loop, and I can cut it here. I can play it backwards. I change the speed and things like that.
Yeah, I would imagine that technology has lent so much to the progress of film composition, but is there any way that it is that it hampers the process? That is there any way that it can become a crutch of any sort?
In one way, yeah. One way, yes. It's but you know, I kind of feel that electronica for me is another color in orchestra, since I study also classical composition. So for me,
mm-hmm.
it's another color. We know how to write for clarinet, how to write for cello. I mean, we know how it sounds.
Mm-hmm.
But if you say, okay, I want some kind of pulsing, dark drone. So, you know, what kind of drone? What kind of pitch? Pulsing how fast, how deep? You know, we are completely in kind of unknown territory, and it's very inspiring for me.
Yeah. How would you describe your process for creating a score? What are the steps for you?
Of course, number one, first I get a movie, hopefully the a locked picture,
mm-hmm.
which mostly doesn't exist anymore, but still maybe from time to time. and I watch the movie. I kind of try to feel like I'm audience. I'm not a composer. I'm audience. How the movie speaks to me. What movie needs, and I kind of
sure.
questioning this kind of, you know, what I need here. What, why is this scene is not complete? What is missing? So I'm asking these kind of questions, and then I try to find the answers.
Yeah. So you prefer to see your preference would be to see a movie when it is locked. You don't want to come in on the script phase or the pre-production phase. I mean, that's rare, but
it happened a couple of times. It's really rare nowadays, unfortunately. I love to meet filmmakers in advance and talk and approach personality, you know, how we communicate and how we feel about each other, how what we like, and read scripts. I'm reading scripts all the time.
Yeah.
That's kind of ideal situation.
So do you find that the directors that you work with are musical themselves, that they know how to communicate musically with you?
Some of them, they are very musical. Some of them, they are less musical. I prefer to talk more kind of an abstract word, meaning like what do you need here? What is the scene? What do you expect from music? How do you want me to complete the scene? What do you want? A big theme here? Do you want some drone here? Do you want some groove here? And so on, instead of telling me, I would like to have some flute solo here.
Right.
So, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Could you illuminate for me certain instruments that for you express a certain emotion that you know that's the go-to instrument for fear or for joy or touching moment? Are there instruments for you that you constantly find yourself going to create those emotions, or do you try to switch it up as much as possible?
I try to switch, and I'm always, my ears are always open for new instruments and for to find some maybe ethnic instrument and placed it in the middle of the score, like for example this famous story with Ronin when I used Duduk and put it in the middle of symphonic orchestra and carry basically the whole thematic part of the score.
Right.
So I'm always up to this kind of, you know, I have ears. Oh, that was cool. Let's try this. Let's play out of the range.
Mm-hmm.
Always kind of
mm-hmm.
try little weird things. But of course, we have classifications of classical instruments. Oboe, you know, you're supposed to hear and see some nature, you know, violin solo, slow, emotional. Your love theme, flute, some kind of, you know, we have kind of this kind of classifications already, and it's kind of coming from instruments itself. So it's kind of logical. But personally, I like, I have my, one of my favorite instruments is cello, because it's so expressive
yeah.
instrument, can play very heroic to very lyrical. So cello, of course, I love violin. I play both of them badly.
No. I'm sure you're being modest. We've talked to many, many composers, Terrence Blanchard and Howard Shore, and on and on and on. We love composers, and they seem to all speak of the importance of keeping your ears open to international music, international sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And did you come originally? Were you born in Czechoslovakia? Is
right.
that where you? Yeah.
yeah.
And I'm wondering, do you find that that's important? To do you listen to a lot of classical music and film composition from around the world to keep up to date on things?
Yes, I do. I always have soundtracks in my car. That's basically most of the place I listen to the music. I have good connections with a big editorial post house. I call them. So what's new now? What's hot? Send me
yeah.
send me something interesting. So they
right.
send me. So I'm kind of like keep ears and eyes what's going on. The place I was born. It's actually a very interesting place. It's in a southern part of Moravia, close to Austrian border, just a couple of miles from a place where Janáček was born. So it's border with Slovakia and Hungary. So, you know, I kind of Čardáš, it's my blood.
yeah, yeah. Do you have... I'm skipping around, I'm sorry. Do you have a favorite composers or favorite compositions that you always go to for inspiration?
Oh, that's so many. You cannot. This program wouldn't last.
Give me a couple.
Well, I love Jerry Goldsmith, who I was it was so inspiring to meet him, and I came to USC. My good friend Christopher Young, another
yeah.
great composer. From the classical side, John Williams, I think unbeatable.
Yeah.
Our biggest legendary composer we have, actually. And many others, Danny Elfman, Howard Shore, you know, James Newton Howard. I mean, there are so many.
There are lots.
There are lots, yeah.
And each of them is versatile in their own right, but there are some composers, obviously, that you can tell their sound. They have a kind of a signature sound.
Right.
I'm wondering, what would you classify your sound as?
That's a pretty difficult question. I think I found in the movies I'm doing today, these movies are more suspenseful, horror, dramatic movies. I found really very good corner for myself where electronica meets orchestra. Because
yeah.
I can write for both. I feel really comfortable with both sides. And I write both at the same time. I'm not doing like a... Here's a sound designer that put something on top of it or other way around. Here's a strings theme and then call somebody, can you do something with this? Can you put something contemporary in it?
Mm-hmm.
I don't do this. So I do things, both things at the same time. So I think that might be my kind of today good corner. But I love also just purely acoustic music, and I wrote a couple of black comedies, which I love a lot.
Yeah.
Love to do these more.
You are very versatile, and looking over your resume and listening to your music, was your big break, was that Nash Bridges, or am I mistaken?
Nash Bridges was the big step to TV, but somehow the real one was actually Ronin and Stigmata.
Oh, well, yeah, you can't argue with those.
Yeah, you really can.
Let me ask you a quick question about working in the TV medium, and then we'll get right to Frankenheimer and Slither. I'm sorry, Splinter. The TV medium, more and more great composers are moving to TV, and I'm wondering, what's the special lore of television, and what are the particular challenges of that medium for you?
Well, Nash Bridges I did, 10 years ago, so I would love to do some series today and see how world changed. I did a couple of TVs last maybe 2-3 years, miniseries. I did some TV movies. I don't know, I kind of write it very similar way like I write for the movies. So, but of course, if I would do series, I have to make 10 minutes a week or 15, 20 minutes a week or something like that, that I have to probably scale down. Yes, I noticed that some bigger composers, they move to TV world. I don't know really why. No.
Well, it's there's, we hear from actors all the time that there's in large part very good material on TV now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if that certainly helps your voice as a composer, the strength of the material, or is that irrelevant?
You know, that's actually, I think you nailed it. I remember this year I was, I had a little bit of time over the summer, so I called for to be judged for Emmys, and I got so many TV movies. I was like, wow, oh my god, this was done for TV. I mean,
yeah.
The acting and the cast, Kevin Spacey, and I was like, oh my god,
amazing, yeah,
amazing, an amazing film job. I mean, both camera, acting, stories. I mean, I was just wow.
Yeah.
And of course, music completely different than I kind of I don't have so much time to watch TV, so I just go through a couple of channels while I'm having a foot massage.
that's the way to live, right there. Yeah.
right. Like that's just, you know, the foot massage machine is for set up for 20 minutes, so I go. So I have a 20 minutes every second day, just check what's going on.
Yeah, well, you got to choose your TV viewing carefully if you only got a 20-minute block.
Yeah, so I can just go from CSI, you know, into numbers, and oh, this I've seen already, I've heard this one, okay, next, okay.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Frankenheimer. Mm-hmm. Obviously one of our great directors, and Ronin is just a dynamic film. Tell me about that collaboration, how closely he worked with you, and how you would describe him as a collaborator.
John became my mentor, and it was very close collaboration. He was every second, every third day in my studio playing. I was playing every single cue in the movie. I wrote everything, every single note I wrote.
Yeah.
I programmed everything. I had 6 weeks to write before we went to London to record it. And John was extremely inspiring, supporting, and kind of with fatherly hand lead me to the right direction. If I, in case that I got a little bit lost, which with the 70 minutes music in 6 weeks, my first big job with the computer, I was struggling with troubleshooting, and so it was not easy. But he was just amazing, and the way how he led me, describing what he needs, what he expects from music to do this scene or that scene, that was just amazing. Not like, you know, I don't like strings here. You know, too much strings, too much brass. Never,
right.
Ever.
Mm. Yeah, what an amazing talent.
Yeah. Miss him every day.
Yeah. If you're a movie fan, you definitely, we all definitely do.
Yes.
Let me ask you about Splinter now. This is getting great notices. It's a, by all accounts, a really fun, effective, scary picture.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about what you saw in Splinter and how those first notes came to you. What voice you wanted to give to this movie?
The movie came to me through my agency. They call me. This is a small little movie with the first time British director. And so I said, okay, let me look at it. And I look at the movie, and I was thinking, wow, such a compact, little, intense story with just four actors. So real. So even Toby Wilkins is a special effect guy, computer expert doing, that was his job, doing actually optical effects. Everything was kind of so real, so organic. With such a great acting, and I saw an opportunity to do something unusual, something supporting this already so good movie. So
yeah.
It was very, very exciting, very inspiring.
Is there a special challenge to doing horror films?
Always, yes. It's always try to find not only horror movie, but every movie I'm looking for the voice, for the tone. What is this movie? What is movie about? And horror, not besides you have to find the voice, you have to also support the horror elements, the elements of the genre.
Right.
It has to be there no matter what. Otherwise, you know. That's so to put this. Two things together, it's a challenge, of course.
Yeah. What do you, because I'm looking at the CD score of Splinter now, and I'm always curious to know from composers, what does the CD release mean to you? Because I know that we've heard from some composers that say they know of some that score a movie the wrong way. They score it more for how it will sound on the CD rather than how it serves the picture. Do you find that in your line of work amongst some people? And what is the importance of the CD release for you?
Well, as a composer for film, the first thing I think every composer who wants to score a movie has to support the movie, right?
Yeah.
That's the nature of our job. For me, there's one more aspect. I like to, when writing, criticize myself and be very critical for myself. I want my music stands off its own legs or feet. It's still music. It's not only, I got so many times disappointed when I seen the movie and I thought, oh, the score was actually pretty good. Then I called to my music editor, hey, send me this soundtrack. And I listened to it. I was like, why did I like it? I'm sorry, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but the person who wrote this score did incredibly good job in the first category. But
right.
It didn't fulfill the second category, which is, for me, important. And, you know, it's fine. He did the job as a film composer. Great. But you take literally any CD of Howard Shore or Christopher Young, right? Any.
Mm.
And add some music there. Jerry Goldsmith. You don't need even a movie. It's already, I mean, I can go on and on with another John Williams, of course. It's just music. You don't feel any cuts or this was a sequence and kind of changes. All changes are smooth, musical, calculated in tempo, rhythms, everything is there. So now back to your question. For me, soundtrack is just, for me, confirmation that my music is it's still music. And it's different, and I want to give my music, besides the music in the movie, another world, another life. Because
right.
it goes off its own speed, and I got, for example, just this week I got an email, somebody emailed me from somewhere, I forget from where, through my website, about how fantastic international theme is in Nash Bridges. 12 or 10 years ago, you know, it's amazing.
It lives, yeah.
Always amazed me that somebody noticed music, because after all, we are musicians. So
we are musicians.
We write and we play.
Well, Jerry and I both, and Jerry Siri is my co-host here.
Yeah.
We both collect film scores, and we're crazy about them. I was actually playing John Williams' score for 1941 earlier today, and I felt like getting up and marching. It's infectious. It really is. Is there a dream project for you? Are you longing to score for a particular genre?
I would love to score more drama or thriller.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my and black comedy. I would love to black comedy. I would love to laugh, and you know, instead of to be scared all the time.
Yeah. Well, Splinter is out now, and the soundtrack is available now as well, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, and as well as your other phenomenal work. And Mr. Smirow, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes,
it's a real pleasure
you.
To have you on. Your next
thank
score,
you.
Please come back and talk to us again.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a good
thank
night.
You. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Aliyah Smirow, the score is Splinter, and we're going to end on a cut from the score. Jerry, good show. Thanks for hanging in and throughout all the technical difficulties.
Yeah, I know. And it wouldn't be Wednesday night without them.
Yeah, it's a great show. We thank all our listeners out there so much for joining us, and we'll be back with you Sunday night. Guess who's on Sunday? Mr. Robert Davi.
Robert Davi, speaking of Bond, one of the better Bond villains from License
yes.
to Kill. And Wise Guy. Don't forget Wise Guy.
He's a great, great actor. We'll also be speaking with Tony Lavelle, an author that we like so much, and he's coming back to talk to us about his new book, Digital Video Secrets. And we got some good shows coming up. The 70s tribute, the E.T. tribute is coming around next week. I got to get to work on that. So thank you all so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Good night, everyone.